Do you want me to sit back down, Your Honors, or you're stuck with me for all of the remaining appeals, for good or for ill?
Yeah, no, it's your preference. If you want to stay at the podium, you can until everybody is settled. That's not a problem.
Okay.
So, your choice. Okay, case number three. Number 21-10306, Marilyn Williams versus Boehringer Ingelheim et al. And Mr. Keller, you're back up again. Now, this case has a wrinkle that Mr. Cartee's case does not have. So let's talk about that wrinkle in your introductory comments.
Very good, Your Honor. Once again, Ashley Keller for the plaintiff, Ms. Williams, and that's exactly where I was going to begin. I'm going to skip over a lot of the jurisdictional questions unless you redirect me, because I think we've covered a lot of territory.
So I think the question assumes we're in bucket two, we're in general default Gelboim, where there are individual claims, and the question is whether this short form complaint is final based on the Rule 41A1 notice of voluntary dismissal.
That is correct, Your Honor. For both the personal injury plaintiffs, Cartee and Williams, you'd have to assume that we're in Gelboim default as opposed to the footnote. With that having been said, there are two notable things that I think make jurisdiction even stronger for Ms. Williams. The first is that I don't think repleading below would have only been futile for her. It was expressly forbidden by the district court's orders. This is at docket entry 2532. She's pursuing only a design defect claim predicated on a misbranding theory. The district court was crystal clear in its preemption order. You have to excise all of those claims and even all of the allegations related to misbranding and any subsequent pleadings. And so the notion that she should have fixed the shotgun pleading problem first, I think is impossible to square with that order, unless Ms. Williams should have defied the order in order to proceed, which can't be the basis of obtaining appellate review. The second issue that I think is important is the district court has subsequently issued a Rule 54B certification with respect
to Walgreens. Have we ever ruled on a futility issue? Let me state at the outset, I do not think that the alternative basis for affirming is a jurisdictional issue. I know the parties argue over mootness. I personally do not believe that's jurisdictional. Now, it may be a reason to affirm, but that's a separate issue. But taking that on its face, have we ever said that the futility of the alternative basis is a reason why it doesn't have to be addressed?
You haven't, Your Honor. It's not a frequent situation where you have two grounds, one of which could be cured and one of which is legally defective and so can't be cured with different pleading. But I think because you're writing on a relatively blank slate for this circuit, there are other courts of appeals that have addressed it, like the Brown and Williamson case, I think you should come up with a sensible rule. And the sensible rule is obviously not go ahead and fix a Rule 8 defect, even though it doesn't cure the legal defect, so that the district court can say, I'm not going to consider the Rule 8 issue because I've already told you you lose as a matter of federal preemption.
Doesn't it tee up, though, the issues a little? Part of the problem, I think, is this complaint is a bit unwieldy in the way that it's been alleged. And I understand that this was the first draft or the first go-around for a lot of folks. It gets narrowed and winnowed. The concept of shotgun pleading is so that these things are perfected in a way that it's crystal clear what everyone's claim is. And certainly that helps us on appeal for dealing with these exactly sort of issues that we're dealing with here. Why is there not value? I'm prefacing all this to say, why is there not independent value, even if ultimately in the merits the ruling would have been the same if you had amended, to require a compliant complaint so that when it came to us, it was a perfect and crystallized complaint?
Well, two answers, Your Honor. The first is Ms. Williams couldn't do that because she was told not to do so. So if there was independent value, the district court blocked her. But let me give you a more practical answer in case the district court hadn't done that. There would never be a ruling by the district court on the amended pleadings compliance with Rule 8 and shotgun pleading jurisprudence because it could just dismiss on the same ground it already did where there was a preemption ruling, for instance. So the sequence would be, let's run the movie reel. If we do what they say, Ms. Williams repleads. She attempts to atone for the sins of shotgun pleading. They move to dismiss again. They might have a sentence saying she still hasn't fixed the shotgun pleading problem, but the majority of their argument would be, this claim is still legally defective. It's preempted. District courts are busy, as Your Honor is aware. They're probably not going to go through the brain damage of reconsidering a Rule 8 issue if they have a preemption order that already controls.
I just don't see the movie that way for a few reasons. I think one of them is, in our circuit in particular, we have a very strong shotgun pleading case law history, and district courts have been well advised. And the other is, we have a history here with this district judge doing exactly that. In other words, she could have done the same thing here and just ruled on preemption without ruling on the shotgun pleading, but she decided to rule on both grounds.
She could have ruled on just the preemption ground or just the shotgun pleading ground the first time, but the second time, I don't think that she would have had occasion to consider the shotgun pleading order, which would create the potential situation where you have an amended complaint and this court, for the first time on appeal, would have to consider whether it cured the sins of shotgun pleading. Maybe if the movie runs my way, in some circumstances, maybe you don't agree it will always run that way. I predict that a lot of district court judges would say, if I've already got a merits ground on preemption, I'm not going to consider the Rule 8 issues. You're out of court already.
Your opposing counsel says that the notice of voluntary dismissal was insufficient here in order to trigger appellate jurisdiction. Again, assuming we're in bucket two. Why is your opposing counsel incorrect on that?
They're incorrect because there were stringent conditions placed on repleting. They were so stringent that she couldn't even attempt to cure the shotgun pleading order. And it was a case dispositive final order for the one claim she wants to pursue. Again, respectfully comparing this to Corley, which I know Your Honor is quite familiar with, attempting to appeal a motion for reconsideration about whether an expert can testify is a lot less case dispositive and stringent than attempting to appeal the preemption order of the district court that blocked the one cause of action Ms. Williams wishes to pursue as a matter of law. I'm not saying there wasn't jurisdiction in Corley. There was in all of the cases that Corley cited, but this is a relatively easier case of involuntary dismissal without prejudice actually creating appellate jurisdiction. And again, there's been a Rule 54B certification as to Walgreens. That did happen after Ms. Williams filed her notice of appeal, but I'd point the court to National Association of Boards versus Board of Regents, 633 F3rd, 1297, 1306 through 1307. That's from this court in 2011. A subsequent Rule 54B certification cures a premature notice of appeal from a non-final order dismissing claims or parties. We, of course, think the order was
that
fine.
As to that plaintiff, not as to a separate plaintiff, right? Remember, Ms. Williams isn't the one who got the Rule 54B certification, right?
The Rule 54B certification wasn't for plaintiffs. It was for defendants. It was for the retailers and distributors who wanted all preemption decisions to be considered final.
As to those that were pending at the time. I mean, Ms. Williams, the district court didn't have jurisdiction over Ms. Williams' claim because it's with us, right?
I would suggest that this case indicates that even if you filed a notice of appeal, which of course means the case is normally considered out of the district court, the 54B certification can still cure that premature notice of appeal. Again, our position is the notice of appeal was not premature. We already had a final judgment with respect to Ms. Williams under the Rule 41A1 dismissal. But if Your Honors disagreed with that, I still think you have to reach Walgreens, assuming the Gelboim issue goes the way that Your Honor and I previously discussed.
There are no... I mean, I read a lot and came up empty. There really are no cases anywhere in the country in this procedural quagmire, right? Not in an MDL scenario like this one with a master complaint, a short form, rulings like the one the district court made where some things can get amended, where some things are gone as a matter of law, where there's a voluntary dismissal by one short-form plaintiff, but not by another. There's just nothing out there, right?
We gave you an embarrassment of riches, it's true. MDLs are not special. They often have procedural complexity associated with them, but the very first rule of civil procedure still applies. These rules apply to all civil actions in the United States courts. And so there's no special dispensation for MDLs. The complexity that the MDL created is why Your Honor is rightly pointing out that this is somewhat a unique procedural posture, but there's lots of Rule 41 jurisprudence in this court and other courts of appeals that talk about when even an involuntary or a voluntary dismissal without prejudice can create finality. Again, the Corley concurrence walks through the very different paths that some courts of appeals have taken and the tough traps that litigants are put into depending on the circuit they're in. I think we're very clearly on the right side of the Rule 41A1 line in this court of appeals. And so your jurisdiction is secure.
Can I take you to the merits a little bit?
Please. So
let's assume I agree with you that Bartlett footnotes 3 and 4 have some vitality. And let's assume that you pleaded or attempted to plead a pure parallel claim, or parallel claim. Let's assume I agree with all of that. I want to look at Alabama law. Because I know what you say the law is there, or the law is generally, but Alabama seems not to have what I'll call a pure defect claim. It seems to incorporate the adequacy of the warnings. I'll just quote from the McDaniel District Court case, but there are a few others. McDaniel, quote, in the case of an unavoidable, this is quoting from the Alabama courts, in the case of an unavoidably safe yet properly prepared prescription drug like this one, the adequacy of the accompanying warning determines whether the drug as marketed is defective or unreasonably dangerous. No AEMLD, that's the Alabama Emergency Medical Liability something or other, yeah, design defect claim for prescription drugs exists apart from a challenge to the adequacy of the warning. If that's the case, then can we say this is a true parallel claim?
So a couple of responses. Parallelism is sufficient but not required for us to win. We're talking about impossibility preemption. There was some confusion in the district court about this point, but if we win on parallelism, we per force win on impossibility preemption. Second, the district court never considered state law and the niceties of Alabama or any other law, and that's not a preemption question. We could theoretically lose under Your Honor's formulation of Alabama law and still win on the preemption.
On my formulation, I quoted from the district courts in Alabama.
Correct, Your Honor. And now let me get to the thrust of your question. Comment K of the restatement, we think, would be incorporated here. And so oftentimes there's a drug that is can't be made completely.
Can I read the next sentence in the quote that I gave? Because it goes to that.
Sure.
It says, because plaintiff must prove, this was fentanyl patch, fentanyl patch's defectiveness through the patch's inadequate warnings, plaintiff's design is underlined, defect claim under the AEMLD is categorically barred by comment K.
Yeah, so exactly. Most of the time, comment K says that you can fix an inadequacy in the design of the product through a warning. But comment K also says there are some drugs that are unreasonably dangerous per se because nothing in the warning can fix the problem. The issue that we're trying to get at, and federal law says the exact same thing, the issue we're trying to get at is there are lots of drugs that are good for a segment of the population. And there may be some slice of that segment that are particularly susceptible to certain risks. And so the warning has to be adequate so that they are apprised of that risk utility. But if you basically have a carcinogen that's in your drug that dramatically increases your risk of getting cancer, to treat heartburn where there are lots of suitable alternatives, comment K essentially says you can't sell that drug at all. That's the Reyes case from the Fifth Circuit going back to 1974. And so the situation you described is the typical case. It's the normal case. It's not the case with respect to this drug that has been completely pulled off the market by the FDA because there are no safe applications. Not for some segment of the population, no segment of the population. No one should be consuming ranitidine, and nobody is consuming ranitidine, and yet they want to say it's impossible for them to stop selling ranitidine. That can't be squared with supremacy clause preemption jurisprudence. The best they could come up with belatedly is something under Alabama law, but comment K would still get us home. And comment K is the most restrictive circumstance. Lots of other states are more permissive on their design defect. Admittedly, Ms. Williams is only bringing an Alabama claim.
Now, this may get too deep into the weeds and it may not be necessary, but does your formulation of the way to distinguish the case that Judge Luck quoted to you, does that depend on temporality? In other words, when the plaintiff was affected by the drug, was it pre-pull out or post-pull-out or not?
That's a great question, Your Honor. I don't think it depends on pre versus post-pull-out. I think if there is a temporality element, you could fairly say it's when the information became available that would have indicated to the manufacturer, to the retailer, whomever, that the drug was misbranded and should never be sold. And so they don't get the benefit of covering up that information and selling all the way through the period of time that covers the MDL. But to the extent that science hadn't developed yet to the point where they could have discovered that ranitidine is breaking down into NDMA, I think that there is an argument that isn't covered by the case law, and you know the FDA hasn't weighed in on it. But I do think there is an argument that there's a temporality element and that they are excused from liability until the point where they could have discovered that the drug was so dangerous that it was going to harm everybody. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Keller. Mr. Mazzina.
Your Honor, may it please the court. I'll start with jurisdiction, and as Judge Luck suggested, I'll set the merger question to one side and assume that we're looking at Ms. Williams' case as an individual case. And
I don't want to interrupt your flow, so before you start, answer this question for me as you go through your argument. You don't have to do it right now, but as you go through, what did Ms. Williams need to do to be properly before us?
Sure.
So I'd like to know the answer to that question at some point.
Sure, and I think the very simple answer, and then I'll elaborate on it through the argument, is she needed to ask the district court to enter final judgment in her case, in whatever form, and since we're assuming no merger, that would be a final judgment under Rule 58.
And again, this does not affect, like, your jurisdictional rules are sometimes technical, they sometimes make perfect practical sense, they sometimes don't. So, I ask this not in a tongue-in-cheek way, but you guys are perfectly happy with Ms. Williams going back down and getting that piece of paper and then coming back up and rebriefing everything again and spending all these attorney's fees doing it all over again?
It wouldn't be our ideal solution, Your Honor, but I don't think it's just a piece of paper here, and that's what I want to be clear about.
I didn't mean to be pejorative in saying that, but it's you're basically saying she's not without a remedy. She just hasn't done things the right way, but given the way things have proceeded in district court, she can still get that remedy, and we'll be back up here in a year or so. We'll be talking about the merits of the ruling.
Let me explain what I mean, Your Honor. I didn't take your comment that way. I think there is a technical problem here, but I think it's more than just a technical problem. And let me explain why. What happened with Ms. Williams, the claim she wants to pursue on appeal is count two of the MPIC. That's the design defect claim. Count two was dismissed without prejudice and with leave to amend, and the plaintiffs did amend it, and they're still pursuing it. The district court found preemption only as to certain allegations within count two. Now, Ms. Williams then amended her short-form complaint she again checked the box for count two, and she added new substantive language to her short-form complaint.
After the MPIC was amended or before?
I believe it was after the MPIC was dismissed and before the amended MPIC was filed.
Okay, so she's still technically traveling on the original MPIC.
That's right.
And so she amends her short form complaint, as you said, adding some things, but that's pre-amendment to the MPIC.
That's right.
Okay. So in that sense, she is, again, I don't want to mix cases too much, but at least there, on that point, she's in the same position as Mr. Carty.
I think,
in other words, the short form complaint gets amended before the MPIC gets amended.
That's right. To that extent, they're the same. They're different is that Mr. Keller described Mr. Carty's amended short form as just essentially crossing things out, dropping claims. Ms. Williams did more than that. She added new substantive language, which she understands as foreclosing her from proceeding on count two, which again was dismissed without prejudice. The district court never had the opportunity to pass on the effect of that new substantive language in the amended short-form complaint. And the reason it didn't is because plaintiffs immediately voluntarily dismissed the entire action.
And that substantive language was, I'm only relying on the allegations that allege a misbranding claim, correct? I'm paraphrasing.
Let me get the actual language. I think it's important. What she says is plaintiff's sole theory of liability is that the ranitidine she consumed was defectively designed under state law, and then she goes on to say, and it was also federally misbranded. That sole theory, so to be clear, the district court said there are many ways a product could be defectively designed, including label, including expiration dates. Those theories are not foreclosed. Those theories are not disavowed in Ms. Williams' amended short form. And I think that's important.
Well, I'm not sure that I read it that way. I mean, that's essentially what she's saying is I'm only relying on a misbranding theory. I'm not relying on the expiration date or the temperature. There was a temperature claim that could be out there, right?
Right. So misbranding.
I read it the same way, by the way. As Judge Luck.
Well, fair enough, Your Honor. We would have liked, had she gone to the district court and said, I think the way I've amended my short form means my claim is foreclosed. We would have liked the opportunity to get a little more clarity about exactly what she was pleading as a theory of design defect. Because it's clear at this point that she doesn't subscribe to all of the allegations in count two of the MPIC, but we don't have any pleading.
Assuming that Judge Jordan and I are right in our reading of it, do you agree that as to that those allegations, the complaint was dismissed with prejudice?
If it's limited to what I guess Your Honor called a pure design defect claim.
Sure. However you want, Alabama design, to the extent the allegations are based on design defect that parallel the federal misbranding statute.
Right. Then yes, I would agree to that extent it was dismissed with prejudice. I still think it's important.
I want to follow up on that. I apologize for stepping in. Your opposing counsel mentioned something. I think it was in his reply to Mr. Carty's oral argument. But I do want to raise it here. He mentioned a part of Rule 58, and I'm specifically referring to Rule 58, subsection C, subsection 2, subsection B, and that states that that a judgment is entered at the following times. Normally, when a separate document is done, that's the normal one you're talking about. And then subsection two is if a separate document is required, here one would be required, when the judgment is entered and the earlier of the events occurs, it is set out in a separate document, meaning that's when it's triggered, or 150 days have run from the entry of the civil docket. That's the time at which it's entered. So in other words, the reason for that is sometimes district judges, they forgot, the clerk's office forgot, and appeals would just sort of sit there and we would have to dismiss. So they amended the rules to say, we're going to assume after 150 days the district court would have done this. Why didn't we fall in that that box if the sole claim was dismissed with prejudice?
Your Honor, to be clear, the claim was dismissed with prejudice from the MPEC, and I think that's the distinction. That rule is talking about a single plaintiff case where there's a ruling on this plaintiff's complaint.
That's sort of what we're thinking about if we're in that bucket. Again, not taking out the merger bucket.
I'm not going to merger, Your Honor, but I think even without merger, the district court has been clear in a whole series of orders. She said, when I rule on the MPIC, even if I dismiss an entire claim in the MPIC with prejudice, the individual actions are all still pending. I reserve the right to say at the proper time and on proper motion what happens to individual cases as a result of my master rulings. And that makes sense for everyone. That's a very practical approach. The alternative is to have thousands of plaintiffs in the MDL all deciding for themselves when they think their individual actions are over. You can risk losing your appeal rights if you make the wrong judgment on that. I think Judge Rosenberg's approach is very practical and very sensible to say, come to me, tell me you want judgment in your individual case. I'll decide if that's appropriate and I'll do it. I want to address the voluntary.
In other words, a dismissal order that was actually effective and final is one that dismisses not only the theory alleged in the MPIC, but also explicitly dismisses the short form complaint for that particular plaintiff.
Exactly, Your Honor. I think that's an important step. And I want to address the voluntary dismissal. I think it's very clear under Microsoft v. Baker, plaintiffs can't manufacture jurisdiction to appeal an interlocutory order by voluntarily dismissing their claim. That's a sort of a one-sided mechanism that would let plaintiffs but not defendants take an immediate appeal. There are two scenarios that my friend referred to.
But it's not really an interlocutory order. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that our law squares, our post-Microsoft law squares exactly with the general statement that you guys referred to in Microsoft. But in that case, the interlocutory order, as I understand it, was an expert issue, correct? It wasn't a decision on the merits, right?
In Microsoft, it was a class certification.
Class certification, right. And they wanted to appeal that directly. But here we're talking about, and we've been clear, Corley and the cases that come before it that Corley relied on, we're talking about merits determinations where one of your claims or one of your theories is explicitly decided on the merits and you want to dismiss the rest of it. You should be able to either get a voluntary dismissal through motion or file a notice of voluntary dismissal. I mean, don't we have a ton of cases which have allowed that?
So respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think so. So let me explain. I think there are two scenarios where this court has said you can appeal following a voluntary dismissal, and neither of those applies here. One is, I think, exemplified by the OFS Vitel decision. That's where the district court enters an interlocutory order that's effectively case dispositive, like ruling out expert testimony, right? And what the court says is, in that situation, the plaintiff can go to the district court, acknowledge, my case is over as a result of your order, and I'm acknowledging that. If the district court agrees, it can dismiss the case with prejudice. Now, it's sort of a misnomer to even call that a voluntary dismissal, but the court has said to the extent that's voluntary, it's not an obstacle to appeal. But the district court has to actually agree with the plaintiff, and the dismissal has to be with prejudice. The plaintiff doesn't get to decide under Vitel unilaterally, I think my case is over, I'm not even going to ask the district court. The second scenario is Corley, right? And in Corley, what happens is the plaintiff has multiple claims. The district court dismisses some of those claims with prejudice, and plaintiff says, I'm going to dismiss my remaining claims without prejudice just to take them out of the case so I can appeal the earlier order. And this court says explicitly, in that scenario, you are adverse for Article III purposes to the earlier order, you are not adverse to your own voluntary dismissal of the remaining claims. Here, what Ms. Williams did is she voluntarily dismissed the very claim that she wants to pursue on appeal. That's not Corley, and I'm not aware of any case that says a plaintiff can voluntarily dismiss claim X in order to appeal claim X.
And didn't we say in Corley that appellate standing is murkier when a plaintiff appeals from a voluntary dismissal, as you noted? But on the one hand, we have held that plaintiffs have standing to appeal from a voluntary dismissal if the adverse interlocutory order is effectively case dispositive and the district court bases its dismissal with prejudice on the fact that its interlocutory decision dispersed of the entire case.
Your Honor, I think the last part of that sentence you just read is precisely what I was trying to say about Fitel, is that the district court has to agree, it has to enter a dismissal with prejudice, and it has to base that dismissal on the interlocutory
order. But those are cases, but those are A2 41A2 cases where you're asking for it. I mean, but I don't think Corley, in fact, I think Corley relied on and specifically cited A1 as a basis to another way to get appellate jurisdiction. Why can't a party file a notice of voluntary dismissal doing the exact same thing, but just without the court's permission?
Your Honor, I think Fitel, which is the decision where this actually happened, says that it was very important in that case that the district court agreed with the plaintiff that its order was case dispositive. And I just think as a practical matter, you don't want to send the message to plaintiffs that you can decide for yourselves when you think the case is over and just voluntarily dismiss and take an appeal. I think the mechanism that Fitel prescribes is to go to the district court and get the district court to say the case is over. And I do think that's an important step because it gives the opposing party the opportunity to get more clarity about exactly why the case is over and to make sure that everyone agrees on what's happened. Briefly, on the issue of the 54B as to Walgreens, I think my friend is right that in an individual case, if a 54B was entered after a notice of appeal, it would essentially perfect the appeal. The problem here is that Ms. Williams voluntarily dismissed her case, which was then deconsolidated from the MDL in March of, I guess it would have been 2021. It wasn't until about 9 months later that the district court entered a 54B judgment in the MDL. So at that point, Ms. Williams' case is not part of the MDL. The 54B judgment does not apply in her case. So they,
and what is she supposed to do if she's decommissioned from the MDL?
Well, that was her own decision, Your Honor. Now, what exactly does she do about that?
I'm not asking for assignment of blame. I'm just asking, what does she do then?
If it
becomes an individual action, then what you just tried to distinguish her case from sort of rolls back around.
Well, it's only as a result of her voluntary dismissal, Your Honor, at which point everything is over.
So understood. But if she's decoupled from the MDL, then she's back to being an individual plaintiff suing individual defendants on one or more claims, and you treat her like an individual plaintiff completely divorced from the complexities of an MDL, then what does she do?
So first of all, to be clear, Your Honor, all of my argument, I've been assuming that there's no merger and that she has a separate individual action.
I got the same assumption.
So what I think she needs to do, at this point, having voluntarily dismissed, I think she would have to go back to the district court and essentially say, I'd like to revive my action, and then I'd like to reconnect it back to the MDL.
You think she's out completely. She's got no remedy. If she goes back to the district court and the district court says, I'm not letting you reopen, she's done.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't have any reason as I stand here today to think that the district court wouldn't let her reopen, but I haven't looked into that issue. I do think that her choice to voluntarily dismiss her action was a calculated risk, and if the district court doesn't let her revive her action, then it's over.
Boy, that would be a really harsh result. I speak only personally, given some of the language that Judge Luck has quoted about allowing appeals from voluntary dismissals, at least in some circumstances. And to layer on top of that the complexity of an MDL with no cases directly on point,
that would seem
like a harsh result if that's what the result is.
I take that point, and that might well be a good reason for the district court not to prevent her from reviving her action.
Would you oppose?
Your Honor, I don't
not in a position to answer that question right now because I haven't talked to my clients.
Is that the answer? I'm sorry?
I'm not in a position to answer because I haven't talked to my clients.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. But again, I don't think there is any precedent that she could have looked to say that would have caused you to believe that you could voluntarily dismiss the claim you wanted to appeal and then appeal it. Your Honor, I see we're almost out of time. I'm happy to briefly address the merits of the appeal if Your Honors would give me a little more time, or otherwise we'll obviously...
No, we'll stop there. If we decide to hit the merits, we'll give both of you a little bit more time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mazzina. Okay, Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm going to attempt to hit the merits, but if you steer me back to jurisdiction, of course, I'll go wherever you want.
It's better that you don't, because your opposing counsel didn't.
Here's the thing. We don't want to have an oral argument where one side gets to speak on something and the other side doesn't. So if you really want to address the merits, then have a seat, and I'll give them 2 minutes to address the merits, and you can do that.
I think that's fair, Your Honor.
You want that or not? Your choice.
Sure, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, have a seat, Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Your Honor. So on the merits, briefly, I think what plaintiffs offer is sort of a syllogism, right? They say, first of all, state law here doesn't affirmatively require a design change. It just prohibits you from selling a defective product. They say part two, a dangerous drug is also misbranded under federal law, and therefore there's no conflict. Both parts of that syllogism are contrary to the way the Supreme Court has analyzed these issues. So start with the state law duty. The Supreme Court in Bartlett said explicitly in footnote 5 that the distinction between an affirmative state law duty to redesign or change a product and a duty to just not sell the current defective product is purely semantic, right? No state conscripts a company into selling a different product. The rule is just you can't sell the product in its defective condition, and the Supreme Court understands that as a duty to fix or ameliorate whatever is wrong with the product. So under Bartlett, the state law duty from a design defect claim would be to alter the design or the labeling. On the misbranding point, this is exactly the argument that was made to the court and rejected in Mensing. In that case, both the plaintiff and the Solicitor General argued plaintiff had pleaded parallel misbranding. They pleaded the drug was both mislabeled and illegal to sell under state law and misbranded under federal law, and therefore there was no conflict. The Supreme Court rejected that argument, and what it did is it looked behind the general duty to stop selling to specifically what can the plaintiff do to ameliorate the defect under state law and under federal law. And if in order to ameliorate the defect, here a design defect under state law, the plaintiff would need FDA's permission or approval under federal law, that is a conflict.
You mean the defendant?
Yes.
You said the plaintiff ameliorate. The defendant ameliorate.
Exactly.
Right.
Am I right that Messing was, that was the application of New Hampshire law? Do I have that right?
Bartlett is New Hampshire
law. Okay. What was the law in Messing?
I believe it was Louisiana and Minnesota.
Okay. So it seems to me that the Supreme Court was very careful in each of those cases to go through exactly what the state law was in those cases, because that matters to the preemption issue, and I think you're describing it exactly correct. But that doesn't foreclose another state that did have a duty that paralleled the duty that's in the FDA statute, correct?
Your Honor, I think the analysis of this question in footnote 5 of Bartlett is not state law specific. I think the point is there is no state out there that says you have an affirmative duty to sell a different product than the one you're currently selling. That's just not how this works, right? The state duty is always you have a duty not to sell a product in a defective, unreasonably dangerous condition.
There are a lot of states out there. I doubt the Supreme Court painted with such a broad brush, and I certainly am not comfortable painting with that kind of broad brush. To me, the question is governed by this could exist, and does it exist under Alabama law? That seems to me to be the question on the merits.
So fair enough, Your Honor. I think that the court's point in footnote 5 was that the distinction is semantic. It's not a meaningful distinction for the preemption analysis. But I also agree with what Your Honor suggested earlier about Alabama law. We obviously made this point in our brief that there's a whole bunch of cases that say Alabama does not recognize what the Solicitor General called a pure design defect claim, divorced from labeling and warnings. I don't believe plaintiffs responded to that in their reply brief, so I'm not aware of any authority from Alabama that suggests that's not the case.
Okay, Mr. Mazzina, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mazzina, Mr. Keller, I would pick one or the other and go, because if not, you're going to get derailed.
Between merits and jurisdiction, Your Honor?
Yep.
I'm going to stick with the merits unless you take me in a different direction. What Bartley and Mensing both say is that if federal law requires the label to be a certain way, and state law says it has to be a completely different way, you can't get around that through a stop-selling theory, which technically could be true, or literally wouldn't be impossible, but obviously is frustrating the federal purpose, right? State law is saying, stop selling if you can't change the label, which is forbidden by federal law. All of that analysis goes out the window when federal law says stop selling. That's the duty under federal law, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, when a drug is misbranded. And there's no dispute about that. There can't be a dispute about that because the statute is crystal clear, as are the FDA regulations interpreting it.
My question, though, isn't on the federal side. You keep focusing on that, and I tend to agree with you. I don't know how else to read those footnotes. I don't know why the Supreme Court wouldn't have carved it out. So I'm with you. But where I'm having trouble is then there needs to be a parallel or something that doesn't fall us into the land of labels and changing designs, which the Supreme Court has told us a state cannot require, and that would create a preemption issue. So how are we not in, whether you call it a perfect claim, a perfect defect claim, how does Alabama fit into that?
I prefer to not use that nomenclature because the Alabama Supreme Court doesn't use that nomenclature. There's design defect. There's no like pure versus impure or misbranded design defect theories. But our allegation is that Alabama law also requires them to stop selling. I'd point you to the Reyes case from the Fifth Circuit, which is talking.
Let's assume I agree that it also requires that, but it doesn't require other things too that are components of the defect claim. And if it does, I like the parallel analogy. I get the parallel analogy. If it requires other things, then it's not quite parallel and it's going to intersect and create preemption.
That's a great point, Your Honor, as well. And the Supreme Court in Bates, which is talking about parallel claims in the express preemption context, essentially says if the state requires an identical duty, but it also requires other stuff, you prune away the other stuff through the jury instructions to make sure that only the parallel duty imposed by state law is imposed. And so that's where English talks about preemption applies only to the extent of a difference.
So your opposing counsel argues that those cases are not all that relevant because express preemption is different than conflict preemption. I know you come back and say that constitutionally it's not, and that we should give it an original public meaning, and which would be consistent with what you argued, but
not just constitutionally, Your Honor, as a matter of logic and doctrine. The express preemption cases are saying precisely what you referenced just a moment ago. There has to be identity between the state and federal duties. If there's any difference, there's preemption. That's a tougher row for the plaintiffs to hoe than impossibility preemption. Something could be required by state law and merely permitted by federal law, and there wouldn't be impossibility, but there would be express preemption under the express preemption clauses of those lines of cases talking about parallel duties. So we're on stronger ground by referring to those cases. Those cases mean that we win per force if their only argument is impossibility. And I'd respectfully submit to you as well, to the extent you're not sure what Alabama law would say on this score, the district court never hazarded an eerie guess under Alabama law because it found the claims preempted and our theory foreclosed by Mensing and Bartlett. A totally appropriate thing for you to do would be to say, there's no preemption here. It's just a question of what state law says. The district court in the first instance should take full briefing and argument on what Alabama law requires. And by the way, there wasn't a state-by-state analysis done below. It was all just global preemption theory and whether Bartlett and Mensing say what they say it says or what we say it says. And so I think that the Reyes case is persuasive authority that you can look to on Comment K, but we don't even need that. If you agree with us on preemption, send it back and we'll join the issues.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
I know that